man is your land. This man is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters. This man was made, you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, Lend-Lease, episode 19. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line this week is Rachel in Idaho. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
And in here in Massachusetts, also on the line, Nate. Hi, Nate. Welcome back.
Hey, Bill.
So the last couple of episodes have been a little bit lighter, but we are going to delve into a little bit more of a serious topic now. We waited a little bit for some of the dust to settle somewhat more on the situation between the U.S. and Iran before we get into that. We decided that we would focus mostly on sort of a broader topic of sanctions on this week's episode. But obviously, we're going to talk first a little bit about just the news itself that is prompting us to have this discussion. So, Nate, can you walk us through the timeline of what immediately just happened? Obviously, we're not going to go over the entire, past 50 years or whatever in U.S.-Iranian relations. But what just happened in the last couple of weeks between the U.S. and Iran?
We've obviously talked about on the show previously the whole situation with the Mossadegh coup and the Shah and all that. So, yeah, without going too back into the history, back to like 1953 or whatever. I guess everything sort of the flashpoint here was the I don't know if you call it an attack or the storming of the U.S. embassy in Iraq. And that came after there was, I guess, a U.S. contractor had been killed in northern Iraq. Following Nawaz Hamid, 33, who had become a naturalized citizen recently, who worked as Arabic translator in Iraq and was killed at a military base in Kirkuk when Iranian-backed militia fired rockets at the military base. So Trump then tweeted out on New Year's Eve, "Iran has killed an American contractor, wounding many. We will respond and always will. Now Iran is orchestrating attack on the U.S. embassy in Iraq. They will be held fully responsible." And so, you know, this, of course, for the military intelligence community, obviously has echoes of the hostage crisis in 1979. And there's, of course, the long held, you know, wanting to get revenge for that. So then, as we were just talking about before we started the show, the military gave Trump the Goldilocks options, you know, one that's too little, one that's too much, and he's going to pick the one that's just right. And of course, he did not. He goes for the most extreme one, as he always does. So then there was a missile strike against General Qasem Soleimani, who for many years has been in charge of the Revolutionary Guard forces or the Quds Force, or, you know, is designated by the U.S. as a terrorist organization. Of course, the U.S. has worked with Soleimani in the past, whether it was to cooperate against Taliban or ISIS or so. You know, it's not like it was very strange when the media all of a sudden started crowing, he's like the number one bad guy in the world. Like, this is like the Avengers or something. Like, this is like a Thanos villain or something. They immediately started pushing the claims that he was responsible for 600 deaths in U.S. soldiers in Iraq. Apparently that figure was actually pushed by Dick Cheney during the second Bush administration when they were trying to push for conflict with Iran then. So this sort of is a number that has some history.
Also, and at then, the time, it's worth noting it was a war zone. Like, they're calling it terrorism for some reason, but like it was U.S. troops being killed in a war zone.
And also, like, these Iranian-backed militias pretty much helped defeat ISIS. So they were kind of on the same side as us until recently. So, I mean, as we see in the Middle East constantly with American policy, just sort of, like, shifting loyalties, and then we'll stab our allies in the back 1 week and then try to get them back on our side the next. And then it's just, or we will sort of ally with very dangerous, especially Salafist forces, if they're sort of on our end, or if they have the same interests as us, or oftentimes be sort of anti-Shia, anti-Iran groups. And then when they get out of control, as ISIS did, then it's like, oh, whoops, so got to have people come back helping us out. So then, then of course, we have to talk about the missile strike that Iran launched on the U.S. base in Iraq. Apparently, it was just some munitions buildings or something. No U.S. soldiers were killed, although I think some Iraqis were killed. So that is something to consider. So, but then, of course, Trump then tweeted out being like, everything is good. Situation under control. And then just, I'm trying to think like what the reaction would be like if, say, like Obama had tweeted that after, say, like there had been some sort of attack on U.S. base, or after Benghazi or something
now,
like that.
Now, what was the part of the timeline where Trump was threatening to blow up all the cultural sites?
Yeah. That was right before, I believe, the Iranian response. And then, fortunately, he did not carry out an attack on the cultural sites, but... threatening to that is war crime, of course, and Trump engages in war crimes constantly. So,
and had, of course, just pardoned war crimes by the Navy SEAL guy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the reason that we're going to talk about sanctions today is because, well, there were essentially two factors that resulted in. I mean, it's still not a great situation. Stuff could still go sideways at any point, but it seems like we have climbed down a little bit off of the brink of, you know, some sort of full-scale war, partly because the Iranian government is relatively more sort of self-preservationist than the United States leadership sometimes is. Basically, the two sort of biggest factors, one is that Trump decided to just be like, okay, well, they've saved face with this military-based strike that didn't really, you know, the intentional misses or whatever demonstrated their power but didn't actually cause that much in the way of damage, didn't kill more U.S. personnel, etc., and we can just do more sanctions. That's why we're going to be talking about sanctions today, because that seems to be the U.S. response on these things. Oh, we'll just do more sanctions and that'll be good enough, which is, I guess, a less bad option than a full-scale war, but is still not great, as we'll talk about. And the other thing that happened was that Iran accidentally shot down a passenger plane of a Ukrainian airline. Still a little bit unclear, as we're recording this on January 12th, 2020. At the time that we're recording this, it's still a little bit unclear what exactly happened. For whatever reason, this civilian plane flew through an active area that it probably ought not to have, but maybe they didn't realize that at the time, and that someone at the controls of the Iranian air defenses probably panicked and thought that it was a U.S. aircraft coming to do a bombing or something like that. The other thing, of course, that is the background for all of this is that in the late 1980s, the U.S. Navy shot down a Iranian aircraft, killing all the civilians. And that was essentially an accident. You can go read up on the details as to what happened there. But the thing is, this has been something that Iran has held over the U.S., you know, in terms of moral high ground for a very long time, partly because the U.S. just categorically refused to apologize for that and, you know, gave out medals to a lot of the people involved. And just has consistently said, like, well, they shouldn't have been there, you know, shouldn't have been flying there, so we had to protect our ships. And in this case, the Iranian president is saying this was an unforgivable, horrible tragedy. It was an accident. We will, you know, hold our people accountable when we figure out who actually did it. Just totally opposite response. And obviously, I think one that they had to take, given how they have spent the past 30 years criticizing the U.S., rightly so, for shooting down the aircraft in the 1980s. So I think that's another factor in sort of climbing down off the situation is that because the U.S. doesn't want to really hit them very hard in the press about this or criticize them for doing it, because of our own record on this, everyone's sort of like, oh, well, that was a really bad outcome to the situation. Maybe we should all just walk away. Not great that it happened, obviously, but I think probably maybe contributed to de-escalation somewhat so far. But again, let's get back into sanctions. This is something that has been just an ongoing thing that the U.S. does. I'm going to go to Rachel in just a moment, but I wanted to very quickly cite there was a June 1998 pre-9/11 paper from Brookings. This is by Richard Haas, who I would not recommend citing in general, but I'm doing this citation just because this is for background on the way that this emerged as a go-to policy tool, and also the fact that this is such an old sort of prescient item. He said, economic sanctions are fast becoming the policy tool of choice for the United States in the post-Cold War world. Sanctions can offer what appears to be a proportional response to a challenge in which the interests at stake are less than vital. In addition, sanctions are a way to signal official displeasure with a certain behavior. But more generally, sanctions can have the perverse effect of bolstering authoritarian status societies by creating scarcity. They enable governments to better control distribution of goods. And then he notes that it's difficult to decide when to lift sanctions, especially after it's become clear that they haven't really had any effect or aren't changing or reversing behavior. And then he talks also as well about the difference between generalized economic sanctions versus quote-unquote highly targeted sanctions that focus on leadership and armed forces. We'll talk more about why that's kind of not a real thing. Then there's also the issue of punitive sanctions versus coercive sanctions, although he doesn't go too much into that. And that's basically the difference between this is a short-term sanction to punish you, your country, for having done something specific, but you are not expecting them to reverse that, versus coercive sanctions where you are applying sanctions with the objective, whether it's going to succeed or not, of getting the country to change their behavior and do something different or reverse some decision. Anyway, one of the key sort of themes that is emerging in sort of professional level discourse among critics of sanctions is that effectively these are starting to rise to the level of being kind of low grade, you know, almost declarations of war in terms of their effect and how severe and damaging they can be for, you know, actual civilian populations. Rachel, you read an article from the World Economic Forum that was talking about seven fallacies of economic sanctions. And so as the U.S. is yet again, for the billionth time, applying new sanctions to Iran, what seven things should we keeping in mind about sanctions?
Okay. So, yeah, seven fallacies of economic sanctions. One is it's kinder and gentler than war. But as we've seen, just looking at countries that we've imposed sanctions on, you see a lot of misery getting just pushed onto civilian populations, food shortages, fuel shortages, water shortages. So it's killing people, and not in a kind and gentle way, but in a long, slow, drawn out, terrible sort of way. Number two, if sanctions are hurting, they must be working. Like you just said from the Brookings article, there isn't really a success state. There's not really an endpoint that says, oh yeah, this worked, we can back off now. There isn't really a good set target for sanctions that has a good endpoint. Number three, sanctions are smart and targeted. That's not true. They kind of collectivize suffering amongst the people. They hurt civilian populations. They hurt the private sector. They don't just hurt like the military or the government. Number four, it's a way to uphold and promote human rights. Countries have used sanctions as a way of pushing out NGOs and human rights groups, saying that they're allied with our enemies. So human rights often are ignored or just trampled on during these times of sanctions. Number five, sanctions are an effective way to bring about regime change. Again, as you said in the Brookings article, it kind of bolsters the authoritarian regimes. It just strengthens them in like an us against the world sort of way. So it's not really effective. Number six, sanctions weaken the targeted governments. Again, not really. Number seven, sanctions are effective in preventing nuclear proliferation. Since the non-proliferation treaty was signed, four nations have nuclearized: Israel, India, Pakistan, and North Korea. And three of those countries did that while under sanctions. So it just, they're not all they're cracked up to be. They're not a good alternative to diplomacy. And they don't really prevent suffering in any sort of way. So not great.
Now we're going to talk, we're going to go through some specific articles that basically prove why a lot of these seven items are fallacies. A good one to start with for the first one is about the 1990s sanctions that were imposed. There was a round of sanctions imposed on Iraq related to their invasion and attempted annexation of Kuwait. There was just sort of an ongoing, very long period of sanctions after the Gulf War. This led to the famous 60 Minutes interview with Secretary of State Madeleine Albright during the Clinton administration in May of 1996. She was actually the UN ambassador at the time of this interview. Correspondent Leslie Stahl said to Albright, "We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And, you know, is the price worth it?" And Albright, who has since apologized many times for this and says she regrets it and, you know, gets very upset if the media brings this up, her reply at the time was, "I think this is a very hard choice, but the price, we think the price is worth it." Again, saying we think that the price of 500,000 children dying is worth it. And that goes back to the fallacy number one, that sanctions are kinder and gentler than war. So although we may have for the moment avoided a war with Iran, it's not going to be a great situation for a lot of the people on the ground. Rachel, can you talk to us about some of the effects in, say, Venezuela regarding medicine? That's one that gets brought up a lot, and obviously, for similar reasons to the Iraq situation in the 90s, has an effect on mortality.
Right. There's a Deutsche Welle article out of Germany. It just kind of has a by-the-numbers effects of the U.S. sanctions on Venezuela. It obviously cuts off medical supply chains. The government and the country has a hard time bringing in supplies to people who need them. So they cited 16,000 people who need dialysis, 16,000 cancer patients, and roughly 80,000 people with HIV aren't getting the care that they need. According to a report published in April of 2019 by the Washington-based Center for Economic
2018,
and Policy.
I think.
Oh, 2018. Yeah. Right. The Washington-based Center for Economic and Policy Research. The Pan American Health Organization had to change the accounts they used to purchase the medicine four times because they kept it getting blocked, says Marcel Quintana, the person in charge of the distribution of antiviral meds to the country's HIV patients. Venezuela has provided that care free of charge for decades, so they can't even purchase legitimately the medicine that they need for the people in the country. According to representatives from Hidrocapital, the state water agency for Caracas, roughly 15 to 20% of Venezuelans don't have access to potable water in their homes because the government cannot acquire new foreign-built parts to fix broken pumps and pipes. So that's something that kind of gets ignored or just kind of brushed over. Infrastructure. They can't maintain infrastructure if they need to buy foreign-built parts to fix and maintain the systems. In response, Hidrocapital ships truckloads of water each week to needy communities, but again, the lack of parts for vehicles is impacting the number of water trucks Hidrocapital can keep on the road. Maria Flores, vice president of operations, says their fleet has been reduced by 75% over the last 3 years to now only a handful of trucks. So, yeah, the people are suffering. It's not smart and targeted. It's just this blanket suffering pushed on the citizens of Venezuela. So it's not kind and gentle at all. The people are suffering and they can't get the care that they need because we are blocking both the import and even just the purchase of these supplies and parts and medicines.
There was also a similar article that you read in Jacobin in May of 2019 that was also talking about the effects on Venezuela. Could you talk a little bit about that?
So in addition to the HIV positive people, the people on dialysis, there's also 4 million people with diabetes and hypertension who can't access the drugs that they need. So even more suffering. And Trump has also pressured other countries not to buy Venezuela oil. They're an oil-based economy. They need to sell their oil to afford resources for the country. So production dropped by 130,000 barrels per day in 2019, more than six times the average rate of decline seen in the final 6 months of 2018. Sanctions have frozen more than $17 billion worth of the country's assets, barred the sale of billions of dollars in trade credits, and prevented the country from restructuring its foreign debt. And the way the U.S. press has kind of talked about these sanctions, outlets like the New York Times and Forbes characterized these sanctions as limited and not going to have much effect beyond the simply political. And also that kind of ignores that the economic and humanitarian crisis that we are engineering is blamed on Maduro, which then becomes a plank in arguments for regime change. So we are cutting off their foot and then blaming the president for inflicting suffering on the country and pushing for the regime change for Juan Guaido to take over. So it's really ignoring the causes of the suffering and misdiagnosing the cure for it, basically. Like, regime change will fix everything, which it won't. They also said the Washington Post, in a piece of reporting, casually asserted that corruption, mismanagement, and failed policies have brought Venezuela to its knees. If you read only establishment media, Trump sanctions simply do not exist. And the Jacobin article kind of points out what, like, the D.C. Government speak. They say they're rooting for the people of Venezuela, but in reality, it means plunge them into such misery and suffering in the hope that they might install your favorite leader out of despair. It's basically a modern day siege, and it's causing misery, chaos, and death for already suffering populations while strengthening the hand of the rulers who repress them, kind of stating that is what Western sanctions have brought to the governments around the world that they are imposing these sanctions on. So it's not, it never really helps the quote unquote the people that the Washington people say that they are rooting for or say that they speak for. So yeah,
the siege comparison is another one I was making in my head as well. Also, you know, as you said, there tends to be sort of a media blackout in referencing, at least with Venezuela, less so with Iran, in referencing the relationship between the suffering on the ground to the sanctions as the cause. The most that we saw, like, there was one of these articles that I was reading where they had quoted somebody at the Washington Post, and he made some comment about, you know, well, there's no doubt that the sanctions are, like, worsening the situation, but fundamentally, this all goes back to, you know, policies enacted by Hugo Chavez years ago about the economy, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, okay, but I mean, you're sanctioning, you're like trying to get people to stop buying their oil and then being like, and the problem here is that Chavez made the economy too dependent on oil exports. And it's like, but almost any government in Venezuela would probably be trying to fund everything with oil exports. Like, that's not a huge surprise. That's not uniquely socialist in some way. That's a bizarre argument to make. You know, like that, I mean, that would be like being like, oh, the people of Norway are greatly suffering, or the people, you know, the people of Saudi Arabia are greatly suffering because of the organization of their economy to be dependent on oil exports. And it's like, I mean, is that an accurate representation of the situation? No. Other things that I wanted to talk about, returning to Iran more specifically, there was an article in April 2019 in The Week talking about a specific instance of an impact that the sanctions, the endless sanctions have had there on Iran. In early spring of 2019, there was huge flooding across Iran, which devastated a number of communities, and there was almost no international aid forthcoming due to sanctions, especially bank transfer sanctions and sanctions on equipment to repair rescue vehicles, including helicopters, as well as obviously political factors. Mike Pompeo told people to donate to the Iranian Red Crescent with no explanation of how, since that money can't reach them due to the U.S. sanctions regime on financial transfers. The article also cites one study of 85 sanctions systems published in International Security identified just 4 successes. Sanctions are, quote, not likely to achieve major foreign policy goals, end quote, the survey concluded, but they reliably, quote, inflict significant human costs on the populations of target states, including innocent civilians who have little influence on their government's behavior, end quote. Now, I went and clicked through to JSTOR to find out what this study was and when it was from. And it was a paper published by Robert A. Pape, Why Economic Sanctions Do Not Work, published in International Security Journal in autumn of 1997. So when we say that 85 sanction systems were studied and that there were only 4 successes, that was as of 1997. And I don't think that it's been a particularly banner couple of decades since then. The article in the week also notes with regard to Venezuela, what if the sanctions plan doesn't work? And then they cite someone from crisis group analyst Phil Gunson, based in Caracas, talking to the Miami Herald. Suppose the Maduro government holds on, and then you've duplicated the suffering and you haven't solved the problem. The prospect that it can be apocalyptic but not produce an outcome can be quite scary, end quote. And that speaks to an earlier point that we made, which is that it's very hard to climb down from these sanctions, particularly because there's so much moralizing that goes into a lot of the sanctions now in the United States. You know, it's easy for an interest group in Congress to push through a round of sanctions and get everyone really whipped up into a frenzy about how evil the regime is and blah, blah, blah. And that becomes very hard to climb down from, especially if there is no actual change on the ground to the situation. So it's kind of hard to get, like, say, okay, well, it's time to lift these sanctions, even though nothing actually happened. And that goes back as well to the fallacy that Rachel cited earlier, which is that if the sanctions are hurting, they must be working. That's clearly not actually the case. Other things to note here, foreign policy article in 2016, criticizing the Obama administration's reliance on sanctions as well. Noting it was such a heavy lift to get successful short-term Iran sanctions coupled with diplomacy, but then the U.S. didn't really stick to it either due to other political pressures, and that became especially true after Trump took office, which was beyond the scope of this article, which is that they just were like, okay, well, you've been following everything that we wanted you to do. Here's more sanctions as a reward. It's like, well, that's clearly contradictory to the objective of any sort of coercion on sanctions, which has to be short-term, and, you know, by definition is undermining your entire sort of thing. And that goes back to, as I said, the moralizing around it. They also talked in the foreign policy article about Russia sanctions. These were devastating to ordinary Russians, but did not result in a Russian withdrawal from Ukrainian territories, including Crimea. They also kind of observed that Russia is such a big economy that it's really hard to envision sanctions having worked. You know, so I conclude that the point must have been more punitive than coercive. And obviously eventually, especially from the European standpoint, had to start lifting it, because eventually these sanctions, you can get everyone to kind of buy in for a short time on some things, but it's very hard to just be like, okay, and all U.S. allies for here into perpetuity are required to not do any trade with this country. That's going to cause them problems, especially if they have greater trade needs dependent on that country. It's the same reason why, like, the trade embargo with Cuba self-evidently hasn't done anything, because almost the entire rest of the world does not abide by it, because why would they? And it doesn't benefit them, and it would hurt them to do that. They also cite a Cato Research fellow, Emma Ashford, an expert on politics of energy, who called the sanctions against Russia, quote, an outright failure, end quote, and said that they have led to food shortages and credit crunches for ordinary Russians and are ultimately harming U.S. economic and geopolitical interests. Another example cited in that foreign policy article is that big example of unintended consequences was an effort to curb the flow of money going to the Al-Shabaab militant group in Somalia. But they ended up just basically cutting off all of the remittance flows, or almost all of them, from Somali diaspora in the United States or wherever to their family back home in Somalia. And that was obviously a huge problem because remittance flows from diaspora communities are like a much bigger economic source than actual, you know, development aid from the government. And the last article that I want to talk about here is a column from August of 2018 in The Guardian by Afua Hirsch. Iran sanctions specifically was the subject of this, and she goes into the moral dimensions of it, which I think is interesting again, because as I said, there's a lot of moralizing around putting sanctions into place, and as she says, less of a examination of the flip side of it. Quote, sanctions are so common a tactic now that we question their utility, but rarely their morality, end quote. And the idea of targeted sanctions, which was, you know, one of the fallacies listed, the smarter targeted sanctions that Rachel listed earlier, she basically suggests that this is a total lie, saying, quote, smart sanction branding sounds impressive, but it is often too good to be true. Under Obama's sanctions, the percentage of Iranian families living in poverty almost doubled. Millions were left without access to essential medical treatment, and child marriage, according to one measure, rose by a fifth as struggling families pulled their girls out of school and married them off early to alleviate extreme financial hardship. Sanctions that seem unrelated to innocent civilians often have unforeseen consequences, like the almost 2,000 Iranians who have died in plane crashes since the country's isolation from the international community began to limit access to spare parts. State control, if the recent history of Obama-era sanctions are anything to go by, increases. They drove out legitimate middle-class businesses and helped the state, or in this case the military, monopolize the economy, exactly the opposite of what the U.S. wants. Sanctions cannot be justified if it's already apparent that they don't work, and yet, as she notes, there's very little examination of that sort of central premise. And going back to that article from the Brookings in the 1990s, it became this thing of like, oh, we don't like this country, we don't like what they're doing, let's slap some sanctions on, that'll solve the problem. The other point that she makes, which I think is kind of interesting because I had been wondering about this as well, she notes that in apartheid South Africa, there were progressive activists who were publicly campaigning for the international community to apply sanctions on their country and often going to prison for it, and that by contrast, we are not hearing that in places like Iran, or Russia or Venezuela, unless you are talking to the like extremely fringe groups that are exiled out of the country, usually in the United States, who have, you know, or like want to restore the Shah, or Shah, like bring
Hadeen Alcock,
yeah, or bring fascism to power in Venezuela or whatever. So that's it from my articles. Nate, do you want to comment on any of these?
One last thing. Saw this morning. Secretary of Defense Mark Esper gave sort of a floundering interview on Face the Nation where he's like, oh, I didn't see actually the evidence that Oka's allegedly Soleimani was planning attacks on four U.S. embassies. But then he's like, oh, yeah, but it probably would have been the embassies. He's like, yeah, Trump didn't cite any specific piece of evidence. What he said, he believed, so like a lot of these probably believed, and there was a lot of people coming out from the briefing saying that the evidence that anonymous government officials used to justify the strike was, quote, razor thin. A lot of people were saying there was imminent attacks, so there was a defensive strike, and I mean, this is all pretty transparently lies, all of it. So, I mean, if you honestly think that, like, Iran would have just, like, done an Al-Qaeda-style attack, like, against, like, the U.S. embassies in Tanzania and, what was it, Kenya in the 90s, where they just blew those up?
Yeah, Kenya, and I think it was, is it Ethiopia or Tanzania? I think it was Tanzania.
I thought it was Tanzania. Yeah. So, but I mean, the likelihood of Iran doing that, I think, would have been pretty small. And, I mean, there's just no evidence. Like, they're not showing the evidence. They're probably because there is no evidence. So, but, I mean, that's all just sort of par for the course when it comes to this type of thing.
Rachel, did you want to talk about any of the articles that I had talked about or general summary thoughts?
Well, I think just kind of a throwaway line almost was, like, how we don't really rely on diplomacy anymore for our international relations. And I know that's kind of been something in the news recently with Ronan Farrow's book about the State Department and kind of the fall of diplomacy. So I kind of hope for the future that we kind of look to diplomacy again in our international relations, because even though it's not flashy and it's not really something that's out in public and kind of easily seen, it is effective in international relations and solving conflicts between countries. And I think it's something that that can prevent a lot of this tragedy and a lot of this like immiseration getting imposed on civilian populations.
Yeah, I just, you know, as I said earlier in the episode, I think that it's probably better to have the U.S. climb down from total war with Iran by going in the direction of sanctions, but it's very bad in its own right, and we need to recognize that. We need to recognize the context of where we come from, and we need to understand that it's still going to have very severe implications for ordinary people. And you know, like, again, for perspective here, there's all this criticism right now about the passenger plane getting shot down and all those people dying. And again, something like 2,000 Iranians have died due to sanctions affecting plane maintenance equipment, which is significantly more than that. So even if the U.S. or Iran is not pushing a button and firing a missile to shoot down a plane, people are still dying as a result of this. And, you know, we saw the example from Iraq in the 90s with, you know, 500,000 children dying. This is still a pretty bad outcome that we need to, like, shift direction significantly on. And we can't keep just letting specific kind of weird fringe and minority political special interest groups keep on demanding that every single situation be responded to in the world with rounds of sanctions. And as the columnist in The Guardian had noted, right, like, you have to examine the morality of the sanctions in the same way that you have to examine the morality of going to war. And I think I would add to that, you know, examining the morale that, you know, you can't moralize around the need for sanctions without also examining the moral consequences of sanctions. I thought that would be something that, you know, would be helpful and educational for people to understand sanctions regimes a little bit better. As we, you know, see this come up periodically in the news, and in this case, in relation to Iran. Rachel, thank you for being on the show this week.
Thanks, Bill. It's always a pleasure.
Nate, thank you for being here as well.
Great to be here.